This week on the BOAG World Show, we look at the challenges of presenting, superpowering Sketch app, and tracking the success of your blog posts. This week's show is sponsored by Proposify and Teacup Analytics.
Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show. My name's Andy Clark and this week I'm joined by Sam Barnes. Hi Sam.
Hello.
Ryan Carver. No, Ryan. What? Where did I get that from? Ryan Taylor.
Hello.
Sorry, I got your name wrong. That was how unprofessional. Can we start this again?
No, you can't. That's it. You only get. No, I'm not editing it out. If you insist on taking over my show, then if you screw up the names, you've got to live with that, mate.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And Marcus Lillington. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning, Andy. I edit the show, so you can promise me anything you like, and I'll do whatever you want.
Excellent. And there's Paul Boag. So, Marcus.
Yes.
No. I can't do this forever because, you know, it's Paul's show, and I know that he gets incredibly protective over everything to do with this. So, I shall go back into my shell.
No, you can't start these things and then walk away. You're doing the rest of the show.
No, you see, I'm no good at podcasting, as you well know.
So why are you doing this, Andy?
I'm doing this because I was so rudely treated last week. Rudely.
You're getting more airtime this week.
Yes, I decided that I'm going to take over the show. Although I'm obviously not very good at it, am I, Ryan Carver?
Some kind of weird wine.
No. Well, I was thinking about a carvery. I thought he fancied a Sunday roast.
That was it, yes.
Straight to the big belly Ryan.
Yes. Ryan Toby Grill. That's what I was thinking of. Right, Ryan Beefeater.
The insults begin. I'm not even speaking to you for 120 seconds yet and already. Jesus.
But you see, this is the thing, is that, you know, Andy, oh, I'm such a diva, I get missed off the show. We've missed everybody off the show at some point except you.
Exactly.
Sam, you didn't see Sam complaining, did you? Because Sam's nice.
You just don't know me that well.
I just don't know him that well. he's probably bitching behind my back. That's what was happening. God, that Paul's a dick. So, Andy, because of you, I thought you said, I think it was last week, you know, we were talking about Supergirl and I said, why the hell do you watch it? And you said, why not? So I thought, all right, I'll give it a go. I'll give it a fair run.
Oh, God.
A pile of steaming shit.
Paul, if you really want to experience the shit, you've got to watch Arrow, The Flash, Supergirl.
Oh, I do.
And Legends of Tomorrow because they all intertwine.
Legends of Tomorrow is possibly the worst out of all of these. I mean, I can just about tolerate the Arrow, but Legends of Tomorrow, please. Apart from the hot blonde girl that was in Mad Men.
You just sound like a dirty old man. Do you know what my wife said when she was transcribing you talking about Supergirl? She said that you sounded creepy. That was her words.
Oh, well,
the breathing, Andy, as well.
It's been said before.
No. In order, because I do, I haven't got to Legends of Tomorrow yet because I'm not that far through them because I can only stomach them in small doses. But Arrow is the best, followed by Flash. In Flash, I love that line, to the world, I'm just an ordinary forensic scientist. You know, like there's anything ordinary about that. That just makes me laugh. So it's Arrow, Flash, and somewhere kind of at the bottom after, you know, the Little Princess and Dungeons and Dragons films comes Supergirl.
No, you're wrong.
I can't believe we're having this conversation. You lot got your pocket money stolen off the bully boys when you were younger, didn't you?
Might have.
Possibly.
But there's what I don't get is there is such good sci-fi, you know, even superhero stuff. What about all the Netflix film? I presume, do you watch Jessica Jones? Do you watch Daredevil?
Yeah. I've watched Daredevil.
But you've not watched Jessica Jones and you've not watched Luke Cage?
No, but I have Luke Cage on a hard drive somewhere, waiting for a plane journey.
Right. Well, what you do is you take You take Supergirl, you set fire to her, right? Destroy all copies of her and watch Jessica Jones instead. Far, far superior.
I'm getting a bit bored with superheroes in general, though. I mean, in The Flash and in Supergirl, all of a sudden, everybody's got superpowers. It's like the bloke that comes in and cleans up at Star Labs all of a sudden got caught up in the particle accelerator explosion and now has these amazing super... Why? It's just getting too much. And the other thing, I think, is there's so many amazing stories from comic books. Why is it always just about Marvel and DC? I mean, Why don't we have a Grendel series? I mean, that would be fantastic.
Hang on. Walking Dead.
Walking Dead is a great example. Yeah.
I'm sure there are more as well, but they've just gone all out of my head.
Even Judge Dredd. God, can you imagine a Judge Dredd TV show? They could do that.
Yeah, but nobody seems to be able to get Judge Dredd right. But it would probably work better as a TV show than as a film.
Yeah, no, I think it probably would, because it was always best as those... I mean, okay, we had the great big, long, multi-part stories, but it always did work well when there was just a killer car or a killer hotel or a killer washing machine.
Yeah. I like the fat people with wheels.
Do you know what? I want a belly wheel. I've decided now. I do want somebody to invent a belly wheel.
Well, Ryan could do with one, apparently.
He could, yeah. He's a fat git.
That's nice, isn't it?
So I bet, look, it's interesting that everybody's gone quiet except you and me, Andy. I don't feel that other people are quite so enthusiastic about...
I'm actually mad on comic books. I'm really... on comic books and I watch all these DC and Marvel. I'm a big Marvel fan and everything else. So I like Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, they reckon that's going to get cancelled, mine. To be fair,
they said that every season's in season one.
Oh, have they?
Yeah.
What about you, Sam? You started to say something.
No, I have got no idea what any of you are talking about. I don't know what happened. I must have missed this whole comic book. All I know is Superman, Spider-Man, specifically the one with Superman with Richard Pryor in. That's why I wanted to work with computers. That was what got me started. I genuinely
thought
I could change the weather with my spectrum. Generally, and tried it too. Failed.
So, talking of superheroes, there is something that looks quite interesting. I haven't watched it yet. It's called Powerless. Have you seen this?
No.
So Powerless is a superhero film, TV show, it's a comedy, about those people that don't have superpowers. So they just happen to live in a city where Superman and all these other superheroes are fighting super villains the whole time. So they spend their whole life trying to avoid falling buildings and,
Can they not move?
You just take the joy out of everything, don't you? It's like you're this big joy sponge.
You're getting to know me now. This is much more accurate than nice.
Well, we should be on a mission. So if we need to convince the Mr. Sam Barnes to read some comic books, what comic books are we going to suggest that he starts with, Paul?
Oh, that's a good one. I think because Sam is such a negative, depressing person... I would tend to go with Judge Dredd, Apocalypse War.
Well, you say that. I saw I don't know when it was, the Judge Dredd movie, not the Sly Stallone one, the other one. And I thought that was quite good, actually. It was a bit darker than I expected it to be.
Oh, no. Judge Dredd is very dark.
Yeah, I liked it. So, yeah, maybe that. Any other, negative, dark comics? They're my type.
Have any of you read Fables?
No.
So this is a take on all the fairy tale characters like the Big Bad Wolf and Snow White and Red Rose and all those.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It's take on all them. It's kind of like an adult version of they've all escaped from their world and they're living in a downtown suburb of New York and trying to stay incognito amongst humans. And the Big Bad Wolf is. He changes into a wolf, but he's a man, and he's kind of the law enforcer, and he's going around solving fable crimes. It's quite interesting, actually.
That sounds very similar to the TV show Grimm. Have you seen that?
Yeah, probably.
That's terrible as well. It's not as bad as Supergirl, but it's pretty bad.
This is really good. They've just finished it this year. I think they did 150 issues. Like they actually made it. Telltale Games made The Wolf Among Us, which is based on the comic. I started reading the comic off the back of playing that game because it was really interesting.
I'm going to suggest that Sam goes to his nearest comic book shop or Amazon, depending on how.
Okay, Amazon.
How lazy
he likes to get out.
Sam doesn't leave the house.
Exactly. Of all the places I'm going to go first, a comic shop. A comic shop in Slough. I mean, it's just not going to be well, is it?
And I suggest that you pick up two graphic novels. One, I'm going to say V for Vendetta. If you like the whole kind of, if you like a great story and you like something dark, I think V for Vendetta is a great place to start. You would actually really like the book better than the film.
Okay.
And I'm going to say Watchmen.
Oh, I watched that too, and I enjoyed that. See, I've watched a few of them, and to me, who wasn't into it, it has no kind of nostalgia to it. So therefore, I'm kind of seeing it as just, you know, a film, and I'm looking at it as any other. And they can't, to me, they seem very, you know, the same old thing. But actually, Watchmen and Judge Dredd and V Vendetta, so maybe you're onto something there. They were quite good.
See, I've never been into comics at all, but one of my favourite authors, Neil Gaiman, who I'm reading a kind of his speeches and intros to other books at the moment, apparently he wrote loads of comics and that's how he started off. So maybe I should start getting into it. Yeah, his famous novels are American Gods and Neverwhere.
You know that they're making a TV show of American Gods, do you?
I do know that, yes. But yeah, I think I'm trying to remember what it's called. He did a famous series of comics, Sandman, is it?
Yeah, that's right.
So I need to find that because I really love his writing.
Well, do you know, and I'm almost ashamed to admit this because I know the entire world disagrees with me, but I found American Gods really boring. I've got like 3/4 of the way through it and I've just lost the will to live.
Read Neverwhere. It's much better. And I think his best story by miles, the most Gaiman-esque of all the books he's ever written, is one called Stardust, which is, it's a bit of a children's novel, but it's not. It's just wonderful. So Neverwhere and Stardust are, for me, the best. American Gods just goes on too long.
Yeah. It's not got any momentum to it.
Yeah. I've read a couple of short stories in this, you know, that involve Shadow since, and they're much better.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting. No doubt they'll get rolled into the TV series when they do that.
Yeah.
Hey, talking of Neil Gaiman, I got to say, I really enjoyed the Doctor Who episode he did. Did you see that one?
Nope.
Oh, no, you don't watch Doctor Who, do you?
I don't watch Doctor Who, no.
No. So it was very good. Well, you know the premise of Doctor Who.
I do.
He did a great episode where the TARDIS became a real person. And actually became this, you know, the mind of a TARDIS ended up in a person. And it was this really weird episode where there was almost a kind of love affair between the Doctor and the TARDIS. And it was really lovely. It's a great, really well-written episode. Yeah. So, yeah.
One of the best lines in that episode when it says, you didn't steal a TARDIS, I stole a Doctor.
Yes.
Yeah, I stole a Time Lord.
Yeah.
I stole a Time Lord.
Yeah, that it kind of gave you a completely different perspective on everything they've been through together, isn't it? It was good.
Yeah, we're good.
Right. So are we done with our random nonsense? Any other comics that people need to recommend? No? Okay. We'll move on to a sponsor then.
Ooh, who's our sponsor this week, Paul?
Well, we've got a new one this week.
Oh, okay.
And you know, this is a guy I know personally, and it's just what, you know, it's a kind of little startup thing that he's set up. So I'm really kind of quite thrilled that he's decided to support the show. So, I therefore feel a huge obligation that he actually does really well out of this. It's called Teacup Analytics. And it solves a very important problem. And I'm actually really enthusiastic about this, and he keeps promising to give me a license so I can have a play, because obviously I'm too tight to pay. I really ought to pay, oughtn't I? That's really bad of me. So what it is the fact that Google Analytics confuses people. okay? And it's true, even as a you know, digital professional, when I go into Google Analytics, I struggle to get really good data out of it. You go into it with a question, and then you go through menus and submenus and all of this kind of stuff, and it's just a little bit overwhelming. And then, so if we find it overwhelming, then we kind of give it to our clients and say, you know, they say, oh, we want some analytics, give, you know, so you install Google Analytics on it and kind of walk away. And then inevitably, a lot of clients come back and go, can you do us automated, you know, can you send us a report every month giving us the key metrics? So what Teacup Analytics does is it sits on top of Google Analytics and extracts actually useful information from it. And then it creates these kind of beautiful automated reports that get sent to your clients, or your clients can access, and essentially then saves you lots of time, and yet you can still charge the client for it. So it's a nice additional revenue stream, because you set up Teacup Analytics, you charge the client whatever for the reports, and then Teacup Analytics creates those reports for you. So it helps, you know, you create these reports for the clients, which obviously the other thing that it does is highlight the impact of the work you do. So they can tangibly see the difference what you do makes. And also it's going to make suggestions in terms of what can be improved on the site, based on your analytics, which again leads to repeat business. So, the reason it came about is they did this kind of joint, survey with GoDaddy, where they found that 80% of digital professionals offer reporting to their clients. But actually only 60% feel reporting adds value to the client relationship. Because generating these reports, you know, it takes time and all the rest of it. So essentially, Teacup Analytics is solving that, the problem of creating these reports, enabling you to get more value out of them and that kind of stuff. So definitely worth checking out. In my opinion, it's underpriced for what it is, but you know, that's a conversation I'm having with him. So get it while you can before I persuade him to increase his prices. You can get it at boag.world/teacup. And it's a great way of getting quality reports out of Google Analytics. Right. I suppose, Andy, I should let you go first.
Oh, well, really?
Reluctantly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Your stuff is so boring. Why don't I? here's some arty farty book that has no relevance to my life. You know, who gives a shit?
I love this podcast. I've been talking a lot recently.
Bollocks.
I do. I've been talking a lot of bollocks recently about how to design beautiful and inspiring style guides, because
yes,
let's face it, some people won't agree, those are boring people, that most style guides, they look ugly enough to have been designed by somebody that really enjoys configuring a router. Jeremy Keith won't agree, but you know, and I'll put a link, because I've been doing a little talk about all of this stuff, and I'll put a link to my talk slides and my transcript in the show notes. But there's been this massive kind of, I don't know, I suppose you call it resurgence in interest in style guides. I mean, they're just like the hip thing to do now. Mm-hmm. And one of the more interesting results of this has been that there's reproductions of some classic corporate design manuals have become really, really popular. I don't know whether you've seen
this. Have they really become really, really popular?
Become really popular among people who know what they're talking about, Paul.
Ah, okay.
The discerning folk.
That's why I've never heard of them.
Your listeners they'll be right on with what I'm talking about. They'll know exactly. Everybody here knows just what we're talking about.
Oh, it's just me.
Except you, Paul. Yeah.
Right.
Clueless.
I do actually know what you're talking about, Andy, on this, or certainly some of them. So there you go, Nurple.
I know because Andy sent me a list of links before the show. Does that count?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You're informed.
I'm fed up of you complaining that I never send you my links before. So I actually sent them to you. I think it was on Friday.
You did. You were very efficient.
It was. Anyway, back to the plug. So there's a few of these things that I've been buying, and I really, really like them. There's the NASA Graphic Standards Manual, which is brilliant, and it basically describes the design of pretty much everything from a NASA business card to the branding that they put on a booster rocket. Somebody gets that job. Somebody gets the job of putting signage on a rocket.
I know that's really interesting. When I was at awards in London, there was a speaker there who was a calligrapher and letterer. And he was interviewed by some magazine in America, and they said to him, "What's your ideal job?" And he said to create the branding that goes on the side of a rocket. Mm. It got published, and then 2 weeks later, he got contacted by NASA.
Oh, brilliant.
And so he got to do it. How cool is that?
Really cool. So as well as the NASA standards manual, there is the New York City Transit Authority Graphic Standards Manual.
God, that sounds exciting.
But actually, it really is. And if you're a typeface nerd, it's got the most complete examples of how to use Helvetica that you will ever see. Literally. I mean, it goes a little bit too far, but there is literally full pages that just contain letters, like every single letter of the alphabet, every single number, pretty much every single character of Helvetica, just really, really big. And from a typography point of view, I think it's important that, you know, if you're using a typeface that's got distinctive letter forms, well, make something out of them, you know, blow them up big in your style guide. Anyway, that's another one. And then finally, there's the, and this is a long one, the official symbol of the American Revolution Bicentennial Graphics Standards Manual.
There you go.
Which is basically...
Snappy title.
It is. Basically, not only explains how this symbol should be used, but most importantly, I think, how it was actually created. And this is a really important point. I want to come back to that in a minute. But you can buy all of these books from standardsmanual.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. And also, there's another one which I found, which is a beautiful reproduction of British Rail corporate identity stuff. And it's collected all of the original sheets from 1965 into one big kind of, I think there's like 370 odd pages. And that's available from BritishRailManual.com. And you can actually get a load of the pages in PDF format online for free as well. It's at doublearrow.co.uk. You'll find it on there. And I just really like these books, and I like kind of geeking out with them. And, you know, that silly Helvetica example does make you think about the fact that when most people are making style guides for the web and they're putting all the typography stuff in there, you know, generally speaking, it's just like, you know, what is it? The fox jumps over the lazy dog or whatever the thing is, or A, B, C, D, E. And, you know, not only are they not really showing the context of the typography, but they're also not zooming in on some really interesting letter forms that might kind of present the personality of the brand. And you get ideas for doing that kind of stuff out of books like this. So that's my recommendation for this week, which is basically, you know, have a look at some of these standards manuals, graphic design manuals, because there's a lot of inspiration for how to make our style guides better that we can find in these kind of things.
Very cool. I got some.
And the other thing which I've just wanted to touch on, which is kind of like a discussion point rather than just the plug of the books. One of the things that I've been thinking of, and it was sparked by something that Marcus said a week or two ago, because he says all the intelligent stuff on this program.
Always.
Well, apart from Sam, who's a bit more intelligent.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
I love the way Ryan.
And Ryan.
Why did me and Ryan get left out?
Because we're the smartest, Paul. We work at a higher level, you see. So we don't rise to the bait, you see.
He doesn't get us, does he?
No,
does
exactly.
You're right.
Unfathomable.
Yeah. Zen masters.
Yeah.
Well, Marcus was intelligently talking about case studies. And, you know, client case studies and portfolios and something in a conversation that we had. And I'm thinking, do you know, the most thinking all of the thinking that goes into kind of making a design, particularly something that's so multifaceted like a website, it never ever kind of gets documented. I mean, you get this highly polished or veneered rendition of a design story when you put it in your portfolio. You know, you gloss over all the things you did wrong and just put in the final result. But actually, the really interesting history of a design never really gets told. And I think that's really important in a style guide, because it's important to actually explain how you arrived at a decision, not just what the rules are. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise people are going to go, oh, well, I'll think I'll try something else. And you might already have done that. So
yeah,
my question is, where do we actually start to kind of document the history of a web design? And is a style guide the right place to put it?
Well, a style guide traditionally has what you shouldn't do with the design, doesn't it? You know, so you have a logo and it's on a coloured background or whatever, which it's not meant to be. So they kind of demonstrate already why, you know, why you shouldn't do it in a particular way. So perhaps that's the point where you need to click through and explain why.
I don't know. What do you think, Marcus?
I'm struggling a bit with this one, actually, because the time that you should basically kind of log the process of where you started with the design, getting to what was agreed, potentially the only other people who are going to be interested in that are other designers. So it's kind of, you might want to log it to be able to present it at a conference or something like that, but I don't think your client's necessarily that interested in that. And neither are other clients. Oh, that's the tough one. That's what I'm struggling with. I'm thinking off the top of my head, if you were going to put a case study on your site that showed kind of like, you know, from birth to, you know, a completed design, I don't expect your client is going to want people to see that. That's, I guess, what I'm struggling with a bit.
No, I'm more interested in its use internally within an organization. So it's this thing that, because this is the whole point of designing a style guide, in my view, is to sell the brand internally, is to convince people that, yeah, our brand identity is great. Yeah, it represents who we are. It's worth sticking to, because what people do, the biggest thing you see is some agency creates a lovely style guide, which is handed around inside the organization. Then everyone ignores it, does what the hell they want because they don't have the right font on their machine, or they can't be bothered to look up the right color. Then you have brand police that goes around and tells everybody off, and everybody hates the brand police, which is obviously a fundamentally flawed system. So what you really need to do is educate and convince people that brand guidelines are there for a reason, and they're good and they're compelling. Now, part of that is making the brand guidelines attractive, which is what Andy has been endlessly banging on about for weeks now. But he's right in that. But then the other part of it is to say, well, look, you know, we did try using whatever boring font you've got on your machine, and this is why we didn't think it worked.
Exactly.
So in my opinion, it probably does need rolling in some way. I'm just not quite sure how.
No, but I'm thinking that we're not very good at this online in terms of the web industry stuff. I mean, you know, if you go back at, do you remember the Dave Shea's Zen of CSS Design book?
Yes.
From what I think was about 2005. You know, I had a flick through that the other day for the first time in about a decade. And I was thinking, gosh, you know, our kind of design sensibilities were so different then.
Yeah.
And the stuff that we were making. And that didn't just go for kind of silly Zen garden designs. It went for everything that was going on in the industry. But where does that sort of stuff get documented? You know, where are we telling the history of web design, not just on individual projects, but on, you know, in the wider sense, because otherwise it just goes away, you know, it goes into the ether.
Well, this is where I think like video is quite good. Who is it who did somebody, did a documentary relatively recently on the history of
Matt Griffin, was it?
Yeah, Matt Griffin. Thank you, Sam. did a great documentary on the kind of history of the web, web standards, really. That was absolutely brilliant and really good. But you could almost do that for, you know, alongside a style guide, just put together a 10-minute little video about the process of creating this brand. I think that might work quite well.
I've done that before, and it does work really well because you get the person who, you know, was an integral part of the solution explaining why, and that comes across, as we all know, way better in video than any print or on the web, in my experience.
Think that it could be rolled into a case study if you did it sensitively, because explaining why you're doing stuff is potentially the best way to sell yourself. So yeah, that's quite intriguing.
I think, yeah, absolutely, because with a case study, it's as much about talking about how you did something and what your process is, because those are the reusable bits. You know, if you just show, oh, here's a pretty picture of a website we designed,
we did this, then we did that, then we did that, and it's like, okay, but if you explain why along the way, then that's it's worth a lot more.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on, because we've got quite a lot to get through. Sam, you wanted to talk about presenting. I'm quite interested in this.
Yeah, so I'm currently writing a talk for Ground Control Conf, which is groundcontrolconf.com. Little plug there. I think you're going to be there as well, Paul.
I am.
So I just thought, as I'm doing it, it's something that I struggle with. It's not something that comes natural to me, but it's not just the presenting that goes into creating a talk. And I've got no idea what other people do, and I think I go against the grain in many instances, but I know why I do it. And I just thought, now that there's sort of a chance to speak to a wider audience, I'll just sort of say a few little handy apps, resources, and just some general advice, really, from my experience. So I've kind of zipped through these if I can. So in terms of apps, the first thing that I always go to is what's called Simple Note. And any note-taking app will do, but the reason I have one that's sort of cross-platform, cross-device, it's simply because I always note down anything, any idea that pops into my head. And the reason I want it to be cross-platform, I want it on my phone, I want it everywhere, so that, because you never know when something's going to pop in your head. You know, sometimes something will happen at work, that's an easy one to log, but you never know. Sometimes when you're just sitting on a train, you have a thought, you can always dump it later. So the first one is Simple Note. I'll put all these links to all this in the show notes. The second one, little app, is for when you're actually presenting. And it's called Caffeine. And essentially what this does is it just disables your screensaver, disables any sleep, just make sure that your machine stays on. I've been at many a talk where someone's screensaver's kicked in, or some notifications or anything, something that's not looked too great on the stage. It's nice and simple. It just sits in your menu bar, and it's on and off, and I think you can change the time. There is a Windows version as well, if you don't use a Mac, called Caffeinated. And if you want something a bit more, with a lot more features, I don't, but some people might, there's something called Amphetamine, keeping on the drugs theme for the season. And again, it keeps everything awake. I think that's for Windows as well, but it has an awful lot more options, like keeping your Mac awake while specific apps are running, or only active when you're connected to specific Wi-Fi networks. Can't think of a reason for that, but I'm sure there is one. I just haven't come across it. So the next tool is actually a site. It's called Script Time. I'm sure there's lots of different alternatives out there. Now, this is where I go against the grain. So, you know, one of the most well-known pieces of advice about public speaking is don't script it. Don't read a script, because it will, you know, it won't sound natural or sound robotic, so on and so on. But actually, I always do, and it's the only way I can do it. I think it's because I'm not very good at sort of winging it. But what I find is that you can write a script in a way that does sound natural. If you write it the way you speak and practice, it kind of just all morphs into one. Also, as you know, Paul, from speaking to you in the past, I find talking really traumatic. And there are times on stage where that script has actually saved me. So just for those few people out there who kind of think that they shouldn't do that and they're struggling to do it with bullet points, you know, you don't have to. You can write a script, as long as you practice how it sounds. But Script Timer, and this is where it gets really interesting, is that this isn't planned. This is more what I found out retrospectively, is that I'd done a few sort of long talks, half an hour, 45 minutes, and kept having to create new ones. And I always had terrible trouble sort of judging it when I'm initially writing my content. And, you know, sometimes I'd go through it for the first time, and it's bloody 2 hours. It's ridiculous, you know? So it only dawned on me after about two or three that I've got some prepared, because I've got a script, and I know that script is, you know, specifically half an hour, 45 minutes or an hour even, I can then plug it in or paste the script into this website, adjust the little toggles, little speed toggles and whatnot, to the, so it's matching the time that I took, and suddenly I've got a word count. So the next time I come to create a talk, I pretty much have a good guide. In fact, the last one I did, I followed this technique, and the first run through was about 43 minutes for a 45 minute talk. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's a bit scientific. It's a lot of effort compared to a lot of people. But this is kind of the only way that I'm able to get on that stage and get the message across, which is really why I do it. So moving on to some advice or resources really. So there's just a couple of things there. One website, one book. One website is called speaking.io. The reason I mention this is that it's just the most sort of practical, realistic advice that I've seen on a site. And it's a bit more than one article. It encapsulates everything. It's much more about the logistics of the day. And it covers nightmare scenarios as a speaker, whether you're doing it for work, you know, for a pitch or a keynote for 500 people. You know, the classic one where they want to have your slides on a machine at the back, and it covers all those things. But when you haven't done speaking, which I hadn't, you know, any sort of 4 or 5 years ago, you don't think about that, and it just is a way to cover all the bases. If you're quite scared about it, you can kind of close up all the unknowns, and it kind of just takes some of the nerves away. The other one is a book that I haven't read, but I've read an excerpt, and I've actually, because it's on A Book Apart, I think it's always quality on there, and it's by Laura Hogan, who's the engineering director at Etsy, and it's called Demystifying Public Speaking. And just from the little bits that I've read, it seems practical, but also quite on the psychological. So I think with those two, you're going to get a pretty decent rounded view of what you can expect of your speaking. And finally, just a couple of, 4 or 5 tips. So these are just random things, no real priority of order. So when you're actually doing a presentation, I don't just mean when you're doing it at conferences. I appreciate that, you know, doing it in front of people at work or pitching or all that kind of stuff, it's just as scary, takes just as much prep in many cases. So obviously, first thing is turn everything off. So your Wi-Fi and your sound specifically, and notifications. As I said before, things like caffeine can help that, but these things that pop up in the middle of your presentation can be distracting. Second thing is to have your keynote or PowerPoint as standalone files. I've seen a few instances where people are sort of clearly running their slides from Dropbox or something that syncs, and for whatever reason, something's gone wrong on stage, and nightmare, they can't get it back. So I've just to really cover myself, I kind of always, once I'm back to the talk, put it on the desktop, it's just their standalone file, no syncing involved. Another one that I use, which I don't know if anyone else does, I've not heard it, but I'm sure people do, it's using duplicate slides for a presenter note. So this is because I heavily rely on speaker notes. Just occasionally, there's you know, you only get a certain amount of space on the screen when you've got the presenter notes. You're on stage, and what I find is people will make as many bullets as they can, and they'll either make them tiny so they can't actually read them on stage, or they'll just make a few and hope they can wing it. But what I tend to do is, rather than this, I will actually create 2, 3, 4 duplicates of the same slide, click through. The audience don't know, but I've got a new set of speaker notes on stage.
Ah, that's clever.
Do you?
Yeah. Okay. I mentioned it the other day, and I realised that not many people did. I just assumed it was... I think it depends. I mean, because I'm so linked to the speaker notes, I think it was a coping strategy. But yeah, same reaction when I tell people that. So it's just a nice little trick. Obviously, when you publish a slide, you just get rid of those, put it into a PDF, and up it goes. But yeah, just a little tip. For people that do find speaking incredibly nervous or nerve-wracking, which I do, I can honestly attest to something which I think sounds ridiculous, which is power poses. I heard of this. I hated the name. I thought it was ridiculous. I watched this TED talk. It's by Amy Cuddy. Again, I'll put something in the show notes. But I watched the talk, didn't think much of it. And then the first time I was going to do a talk that made me very nervous was, I don't know, back in 2012, I think, or 11, with Brett Harnett in London. And we did a workshop, and we expected I think we charged like £10 just for the sake of people coming. And I think we expected about 20, 30. And we ended up with 100 people on the door, and people from Saudi Arabia and Australia flying over, crazy, for a 3-hour workshop in London. But because of all this, as people were arriving, I suddenly got really scared. I started shaking, and I was, you know, I was in trouble, to be quite honest. So I think, I don't know what made me remember these things, but I went away from everybody before the event started and did these power poses, and do you know what? It worked. It bloody well worked. And so there was also another instance where I did my first sort of really big talk in Philadelphia, like, you know, same stage as Jeffrey Zelman and people like that. And I was absolutely bricking it. And there's actually a really perfect conference image they took. Perfect, like speaker, audience, everything's perfect. And then right at the back, there's this bald-headed git standing up with his hands on his hips, looking like ruining the photo completely. just want to say, power poses, like, ignore the skepticism and actually give it, watch the video and give it a go. It really, really does work. And two more quickly. So when it comes to people saying a lot, I do this. I've somehow morphed into saying, you know, rather than but whatever. Everyone's got the kind of space filler when they're talking, and I think everyone would like to get rid of it if they can. And one technique I found that does actually seem to work, which is incredibly simple, and you can try this like just reading something at home if you want. If you hold something in your hand, say either it's a pen or you've got the clicker or anything at all, as you're about to say or your filler, in my case, you know, if you just rub it, it sounds strange, but if you just touch it, rub it, if you do something conscious, for some reason that stops you saying or you know or your filler. I haven't tried it on stage, but I kind of want to. So, but yeah, it has worked. And finally, contingency plans. As a project manager, ex-project manager, this is always something that we think of, but I've seen so many people fall on their arse on stage when the slides go wrong and they're stuck. So my advice, and this is something I always do, and it seems a bit over the top. I haven't needed it, I hope I never do, but if I do, it'll pay off. When you're going up there onto stage, you take a USB key with your presentation backups, in both, you know, PowerPoint, Keynote, whatever you use, but also PDF, and also something, a small device, like an iPad mini with your presentation that's ready to go. The theory is that if everything dies, I can just pick this device up and just continue. Even if there's no slides, I can still continue with my talk. Yeah. That's it, really. Just a few little things as I'm doing it that I've picked up along the way that I think we'll take for granted, but I'm sure we could do a whole show on it, really. But yeah, that's for me.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many good things in there. And you're right, you could easily do a whole show, because I'm sitting here thinking, you know, never rely on Wi-Fi. Yeah. If at all possible, don't connect to a live website. You know, work on the assumption audio isn't going to work, because that's another common one that often seems to screw up. What does it say, Sam? Mm. You know, you mentioned that site that had loads of solutions. How does it solve the problem of, you were saying about how they want the blooming... You know, they want to do the slides from the back and you want to be able to see your notes.
Well, I mean, I didn't learn it from there. I learned it from a course or a workshop in Brighton by Errol Balkin. And it was really about talking to the event organisers beforehand. So especially when you're starting out, it's a very daunting thing. And you kind of just take that approach of, I'll take what I'm given. Yeah. Like, it's you on stage. It's you, you know, at the end of the day, who's up there. And I think that the one thing that taught me and one thing is just to... Do your talking, communicate with the event organizer, tell them what you would like, find out the setup. In the very worst case, if you can't affect the setup and you still want to do the event, you can at least prep for it. So I remember going to Dublin to do a talk for an agency, and the situation there was bizarre. I mean, it was understandable, because a lot of people can do this. They don't need the kind of, they don't rely on presenter notes. So it's not a big deal for them. But for someone that does, it's a big thing. This was actually in a cinema. So we're doing the event in the cinema. So you had the big screen and you're there, but the laptop was going to be in the little projectors room, right? So there was no way to connect the screen to your laptop on the lectern.
Right.
So I did this really weird thing where I had my machine, my laptop, on the lectern in front of me, mm-hmm. With one clicker, and I had another clicker that actually would go to the one at the back, and I was using two clickers. So I did get into a bubble once, but no one noticed. But the point is, I didn't know about this before. So you find out the setup, you find out things like, you know, what ratio your slide should be, and everything completely.
I have speaker agreements now, where I get the organizers to sign an agreement between us. Mm. And that always outlines all this kind of stuff. You know, there will be audio, there will be Wi-Fi, there will be, you know, whatever I need for the presentation. I will be able to give my notes from the front. Yeah. I think you just lay it out black and white. Don't make any presumptions. Because I'm amazed how many people who maybe have run conferences for years and years and years, because they haven't, they're not actually the speakers, they don't necessarily think of all the things you need as a speaker. Yeah. Anyway, we really ought to move on. We're running out of time. Ryan, you haven't got hope this week, mate.
No, let Ryan go next. I don't mind missing out, because I'm not a little child like Andy.
No. I shouldn't let Ryan go next because he was the only one of you that didn't come through with a list of things that that he was going to cover. So
I like mine to be a surprise.
Okay,
plus I'd not decided until about 5 minutes before I picked up the call.
All right then, Ryan, go on, give us yours.
Okay, so do any of you guys use Sketch?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So InVision app have released a plugin. I'm not actually sure how long ago it was released, but Dan's been playing around with it, and it's really cool. It's called Craft. Yeah.
That was going to be my choice for this show, Ryan.
There you go. I've stole it.
That's why you let us know beforehand. Fortunately, we're not going to get to me. But yeah, I love Craft. Go ahead.
Yeah, so Craft's really cool. I've not played with it too much. Dan's been playing with it a bit more, but it's a plugin that allows you to kind of feed data into your designs. So it has some built-in options, so it can pull an image from Unsplash and just, you know, if you've got repeating elements in your sketch, it just uses different images from Unsplash or whatever, you know, other services, and if it can get, you know, generated names, so you've actually got real names in your designs and or addresses or various bits of pieces, and as you're repeating elements and stuff, it just populates it with lots of real data rather than lorem ipsum and random stuff, and it just really increases how rapidly you can put together designs and actually make them look more like real world examples of how they're going to look, and you can hook it up to your own APIs as well, so you can pull content in from like your Shopify store or any other service that you want to pull data from and actually use that in your designs, real data, and hook it all up. It's really cool. It's kind of a developer-y element pulled into a design system, which I quite like. So I just wanted to mention that one because we've been playing with that recently and it's really cool.
It's got some other great features in it that I like as well. For example, you can create reusable styles across things, so keeping your colors and typography consistent. Yeah. You can duplicate elements as well. So, you know, if you say you want to create a list of news stories, for example, it will automatically duplicate those news stories, but it can also do something very clever, which is you can go to a website and click on say if you want let's use the news stories as an example. So you've got a list of news stories and you want to quickly add those news stories into your mock-up. So you go to a website which has got that list of news stories in it, click on the title, and it will automatically populate the boxes with the news story titles from the website.
Yeah.
You know, all of these kinds of things, you can easily add images in from websites and, like Ryan said, live data as well, you know, or not live data, but dummy data, email addresses, street names, telephone numbers, yeah, men's names, women's names, you know, animals, anything you want, really.
Well, I think the interesting thing I found interesting for it from a developer point of view is if you build a system that's got an API, and then your designers are then building new features or something like that, that you can use the API from your system to pull data from your system into the designs that they're working with, which I think is just pretty cool. Mm. But an extension of this is if you use sketch files on InVision, have you seen the inspector that they've now got, which is in beta? So you can actually, you upload your sketch designs into InVision, and when you preview that, there's an inspector button. And when you go to that, it gives you, it like generates some CSS on different components that you click on, which you wouldn't use in your, for like true production stuff. But I've found it really useful for just grabbing gradients, you know,
yeah,
which can be quite complicated in some cases when your percentage points are all over and your RGB values. It's really nice for just quite kind of quickly selecting a component, getting the gradient or a drop shadow or a box shadow, you know, just getting those values, which, you know, don't take long to get, but you're just saving, like, every time you do it, you're saving like 10 seconds because you can just click on it and copy and paste that through. Just speeds up your process a little bit. So I quite like what InVision are doing with Craft and this kind of integrated process, which is making designers a bit more efficient in the way that they're designing things, but also making it easier for developers to get what they need when it comes to actually building it as well.
Good stuff. Do you know what? I'm going to squeeze in one more. before we go, because it's a nice quick one. I wanted to mention something called postreach.io. So if you're somebody that does blogging, one of the biggest challenges you face is you shove out blog posts on a weekly basis and you're not really that sure which ones are working well and which ones are not. You know, you see anecdotal evidence on how much they're tweeted, whether people comment on them. You look at your analytics and you can see, you know, how much traffic's been driven to them. But you've got no kind of nice summary of how all this comes together. And that's where something called postreach.io comes in, where essentially you connect it to your RSS feed from your blog. So it pulls in all your blog stories. You connect it to Google Analytics so it can bring in the traffic from that hits the individual blog post. But it will also look how many times it's been tweeted, how many times it's been, you know, shared on other networks, how many times people have commented on it, liked it, all of those kinds of things. So you get a real picture of how well your different blog posts are performing. Which is great. And then it's got an added feature where you can put in any one of your competitors, so somebody else's blog posts, and see how well those have performed. So you can see how well you're doing against your competition, which I think is a really useful little thing. If you're a writer, you know, that does a lot of blogging, if you're a marketing specialist, or if you're just someone that's running a personal blog, I use it on mine to help me kind of decide what topics to be writing about, based on what's worked well in the past. So I just thought I'd throw that into the mix. Okay, so I think that about wraps up our discussion portion for this week. I wanted to quickly mention our second sponsor, which is Proposify, who are continuing to support the season, and we really appreciate that they're doing that. So they've got some great features on their application to ensure that you're always closing those deals and you know, getting those proposals signed off in as efficiently and successful way as possible, especially when it comes to larger sales teams. So Proposify is quite a robust product. It's not just for freelancers, it's also for, you know, agencies that have got multiple people working on proposals at any one time. So they've got things like roles and permissions, workflow, all that kind of stuff. So first up, you can set and manage multiple sales teams and their proposal activities. So each team's proposal progress can be tracked and success can be tracked within those teams and what's happening within the pipeline. So that's really good if you've got, you know, you're running an agency with multiple salespeople. You've also got control over how those proposals all, to ensure consistency in your proposals, control over the content, the proposals themselves, over the templates. You can set up roles and assign permissions, including which team members can access which bits of sections of Proposify, from account settings all the way through to actually sending the proposals. So you can prevent people sending out proposals before they've been properly reviewed. You can manage the resources by attaching reference files for your team. So, for example, RFP details can be attached to an individual team. And you can also have internal comments when you're editing the proposals to make sure that it kind of, you know, that is being properly peer reviewed within the organization before it's been sent out. Then, of course, you can manage multiple brands as well, which can be useful in some organizations. You can add logos, custom addresses, custom domains, and even custom emails for each of the different teams. So if you've got like your agency split down into different sectors, for example, which is quite common, you have, you know, a sales team just specializing in higher education or another one in charities or whatever, all of that can be managed through Proposify, and it gives you the ability to effectively manage multiple companies using only one Proposify account, or at least multiple divisions within a company. So it's a good solution for larger agencies too. All right, well, that's Proposify. You can find out more about that by going to proposify.biz/BoagWorld. Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
I've got loads of jokes. I'm not.
I know, it's gone mad on the Slack channel, hasn't it?
It's mainly Daryl Snow. Thank you, Daryl, who's given me loads of jokes over the years. But there's one of my favourites, which I have told on the show, but it's probably a long time ago. So I'm just going to do this one again because it's a cracker. What's the best part about living in Switzerland?
Go on.
Oh.
I'm not sure, but the flag is a big plus.
Oh.
That's good. Come on.
Yes.
I very vividly remember you telling that before, so it was a bit wasted on me, I'm afraid.
Oh.
No, I like it.
But I've got loads, so hooray. I'll do one.
Hooray.
Time flies like an arrow. Fruit flies like a mango.
Fruit flies like a mango.
Oh, yeah, of course they do, yeah.
I need, well, I need a quicker audience, obviously.
Oh, I got it. Don't get me wrong, I understood.
Daryl's jokes are obviously of appropriate quality, let's put it like that. But if you would like to provide a higher quality of joke for Marcus to bastardise, then if you go to boagworld.com/slacking, you can join our Slack channel.
Yes.
We've actually got loads of different channels now. So there's the general chat, obviously. There's if you've got questions, you know, because you're an external agency of how to run an agency, that kind of stuff, there's a place dedicated to that. There's a place dedicated for in-house teams. Dedicated for resources, you know, of cool apps and things that you found, which actually would be really good if you put some stuff in there for this show. And also now I've just added a jobs board as well. So if you've got a job available or are looking for a job, then you can post stuff in there as well. So it's quite good. Our Slack channel's doing well these days.
God, you're going to be inundated with recruiters in there now. You have to watch that.
Oh, no, I'd just ban them.
Good.
That's the great thing about Slack, isn't it? You've got 100% control over it. So, yeah. I quickly wanted to mention my upcoming workshop, Sorry. It's called Sorry, apparently. There you go. Just to say, I'm running a virtual workshop soon. You can find out more about it at boag.world/workshop. It's on persuasive design. And I would love you to join me. So, Marcus, where can people find out more about you?
On headscape.co.uk. That's your best bet.
Okay. And Ryan, where people can people find out about you?
Our website is nerdivadestudio.com, and I'm on Twitter at Ryan Havoc.
And Sam?
Twitter is at the Sam Barnes, and the site is thesambarnes.com.
Okay. So thank you very much. Oi. For listening to this. You really think I'm going to let you plug something after you just snored through my workshop? Go on, then spit it out.
You can follow
blah,
me.
Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, sod off.
Blah, blah. Now, go on, seriously. Seriously.
You can follow me on Twitter at Malarkey or my website stuffandnonsense.co.uk.
So that wraps it up for this week's show. Check out my workshop at boag.world/workshop. And thank you very much for listening. We'll speak again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.